impact of globalization on large sectors of the white working class, the hollowing out of the factory economies in the Midwest, and so on and so forth, the challenges being faced by U.S. agriculture. And Trump really represents also a desire of the richest people in the United States to give no quarter whatsoever. I mean, you look at his first term, eliminating all regulations that had anything to do with protecting workers, lowering the taxes for the richest individuals, doing everything he could to rip up the social safety net. He represents the mobilization of the grievance politics of people. I mean, this is why he talks a lot about wars, too, because there's so many people who've been affected by, you know, the destruction of the economy with quote-unquote globalization, the impact of these wars all around the world waged by the neocons over all these years. And Trump is able to manipulate that anger, that frustration, that hatred in order to mobilize a program of very wealthy people who say, hey, the U.S. economy is losing dynamism and the only way it can get it back is to grind more people deeper into the ground for less money with fewer benefits and less protections on the job on a daily basis. And so ultimately, it's an extremely elite agenda that has mobilized around this sort of quote unquote populist basis by taking advantage of the contradictions that have been introduced into society by the bipartisan consensus that we've seen since the Reagan administration.
Would you use the term fascist to describe his politics?
I think it's certainly heading in that direction. I think that it has a semi-fascist sort of piece to it. Obviously, there's some fascistic people nested within it. But I think we have to not be cavalier about this when we see. I mean, it was easy to look at something like January 6th, and it seemed like it had kind of a bumbling, stumbling reality to it. And looking at the whole attempt to say, the election was stolen, some of it seemed so ridiculous, like in Arizona, where they were bringing out the black lights to see if there was bamboo in the paper. I mean, it's so laughable in many ways. But then when we take one step back and think, well, wait a second, this guy was the president. He was backed by many of the richest people in the country, and he waged a huge multi-month campaign to try to overturn the election on the basis of extreme lies to implement an extreme right-wing agenda. I mean, that's a very dangerous anti-democratic course. And when we look at the rise of the Nazis, this is basically exactly what happened, is that they held themselves up, similar to Trump, as paragons of democracy. That's the kind of irony, is they were actually appointed because they said, no, we're going to guard the system. But you had all the different sort of pieces that were happening and were coming together, and people just didn't really think that it was going to be as serious as it seemed. And the rich people in Germany felt, well, we could basically control Hitler. We can use him for what we want against the communists, against the left wing, but we can control him. They're just kind of bumbling, stumbling. These guys aren't really representing anything. And then you wake up in 1934 and you're in a very different situation. So I think the sort of cartoonish buffoonishness of Trump, some of it I think may even be an act, because it can, I think, lower our defenses about what's really coming here. But the very fact that he tried to overturn an election that was not stolen and people have to really embrace this. The guy's theory was that there was a secret plot launched by Hugo Chavez in 2012 to rig the voting machines all across America to somehow defeat Donald Trump 8 years in the future when no one knew he would ever be the president, and that China also helped by shipping in hundreds of millions of ballots, and that millions of immigrants voted illegally. I mean, it's an insane sort of thing. And so it seems so crazy, but, you know, he almost succeeded.
And to echo that Hitler terminology, you know, he's been talking about foreigners, immigrants, poisoning the bloodstream. I mean, that's right out of Nazi ideology.
100%. And we see some of the people who are around him. I mean, Steve King, who's now out of Congress, but he said, you know, you can't have a country with other people's babies. You have this whole history, attempt to have this false history of America where you can't talk about the genocide of Native Americans, where you don't talk seriously about slavery or any of these different pieces, where you suggest every immigrant coming to the country is somehow some sort of criminal. I mean, every study that's been shown on this shows that immigrants to the country are committing less crime than people who are born in this country. But nonetheless, we still have this mythology that's being promoted by Trump and others that somehow immigrants are the source of crime. I mean, all these things are very indicative of certainly the Nazis, but it's also very indicative of the fascism in the U.S. that the Nazis learned from, the Jim Crow South, which the Nazis were openly saying, hey, we're trying to copy some of what they're doing there in the South in the United States in terms of the eugenics laws that existed that had been established in many of these states, in terms of the race laws laws around intermarriage and all these different pieces. They're saying they're learning from the state of Virginia, Alabama, Mississippi, all these places who used to use a similar form of rhetoric and were also extremely anti-immigrant in terms of their context and using a similar thing. So it's, you know, really drawing from, I think, this almost fascistic strain of U.S. politics that the Nazis themselves saw and saw something in it for them to actually learn from, and that unfortunately now seems to be growing back up in the U.S. political scene.
Help me to understand that after taking one legal hit after another, his base, his followers, remain steadfastly loyal to him. What's going on there?
You know, I wish I fully understood. I mean, I think Trump has very successfully created a narrative that everyone is out to get him and that there is a range of unscrupulous plots that are designed to destroy him and take him down to such a degree that anything that happens to him legally seems to reinforce that case. And since most of the cases are coming from Democratic district attorneys and, you know, the Biden-controlled Justice Department, it builds right into this narrative he's been building up for years of, like, these people are out to get me. And I think because he builds his politics on sort of a grievance-based politics of people, rightly or wrongly, who feel left out and marginalized from society, whether that's right or wrong, that's certainly how they feel. They're also sort of primed for this kind of peace because they feel like the same forces are against them. And I think the way Trump talks about it, it's not about me, it's about you. They don't want to stop me, they want to stop you, I think builds very powerfully into the sense of people that there's sort of this liberal swamp, globalist elite that has been trying to destroy them for years and is responsible for everything bad in their lives, and that they finally got someone who represents them and look, they're trying to take him down. And unfortunately, the way the Democratic Party is waging a lot of this is helping Trump. Because instead of talking about the fact that Trump, when he was president, made it easier for you to be paid less when you work overtime, that Trump, as president, made it easier for people working Uber to not be considered employees and to get paid even worse, that Trump was the one who was eliminating the ability of families to be able to get some of the basic services they need when they don't have enough money. Instead of talking about that, they're just talking about, oh, how he's mean, he's rude, he's racist. And I mean, these things are all true, but to the base of people he's appealing to, they don't mind those kind of things. And so the type of attacks that are happening against Trump from the Democrats do make it appear, I think, oftentimes that it's an elite attack to try to take out Trump in some unscrupulous way, because it's not actually grounded in a critique of what Trump represents in a way that could even potentially speak to those people.
Ralph Nader ran for president twice on the Green Party ticket, twice as an independent. Cornel West has started a campaign for the presidential nomination. What about third parties and the space that they have or don't have to even exist?
Yeah, first presidential ballot I ever cast, Ralph Nader, 2004. And I think that, you know, one of the biggest challenges for third parties is the system is set up to keep them out of the game. I mean, you have to collect tens of millions of signatures, but it's even really worse than that because it's state by state and each state has different rules. And some states, you know, they say you need like 250,000 signatures in 4 weeks and you have to have 10,000 in every single congressional district. I mean, it makes it near impossible unless you're a billionaire like Ross Perot, right? And you can pay unlimited amounts of money to have people go around and collect signatures for you. But the deck is stacked against you in so many different ways. You know, you're kept out of the debates. The mainstream media doesn't cover you. But nonetheless, I still think that third party presidential candidates, third or fourth or fifth party presidential candidates, have the opportunity to reach huge numbers of people and make big impacts on society. And look, Ralph Nader made such a big impact in 2000, they tried to do a character assassination on him and say he was the worst person in the history of the world because of the way that that election played out. And I think we've seen in many different cases, you can drive the agenda in important ways. I mean, we go back to 1948, Henry Wallace, go back to 1912, 1920, Eugene Debs. I mean, even though these were third party candidates that didn't win the election, we still remember them, you know, decades later because the impacts of their campaigns helped drive the political arena. And I think what we're seeing this year is a huge uprising against the two major parties. I don't know how it's going to end up. You have Cornel West, you have Jill Stein, you have Claudia De La Cruz, you have, you know, even though I wouldn't consider him a left-wing candidate, but he's out there, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I mean, you have a chance that it could be possible that, you know, quote-unquote third-party candidates could get 25, 26, 27, 28% of the vote. So, you know, let's say a fifth to a third of the voters may choose some other candidate, which is not unprecedented, but it's been a very long time since there's been that kind of challenge to the two-party system, and coming from a lot of different ranges. And I think that's what's great about it. I think you have, you know, looking just at the left, Cornel West, Jill Stein, Claudia De La Cruz, you know, all coming from a left-wing perspective, all talking about the wars, but still slightly different flavors. And I think for somehow some people feel like that's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing, because I think these are the kind of conversations we need to have about how the world is moving forward. And I wish those were the three candidates who were debating, but I think you're going to see all three of those candidates get a lot of support. More support than you normally see, because I think people really, really want to see a change in this country and are excited to see finally, like, you know, intelligent criticism coming forward.
And making that connection between Birmingham and Bethlehem.
You know, when we look at the long history of Black Palestinian solidarity in this country, you know, from Birmingham to Bethlehem, I think is an amazing sort of slogan to put it together, because Birmingham as the crucible of the civil rights movement and Bethlehem as the crucible in many ways of the liberation theology tradition that the civil rights movement was based on. And to see these abuses, this apartheid, this occupation happening in historic Palestine, creating a strong cultural connection and reality to that history and that rhythm and that spirit of the Black Liberation Movement that over the years has really built strong ties between the Black Liberation Movement, the Palestinian Liberation Movement organizationally and at the grassroots, because it speaks to the similarities of the struggle. It speaks to the similarities of the reasons why we're both in oppressed situations. It speaks to the reality of the world today. And I think it also speaks to the rhythm and the culture of how Black people have historically liberated themselves.
And in terms of history, Malcolm X played a pivotal role in making that connection and expanding the boundaries of permissible thought.
Malcolm X, 100%. I mean, he went to Gaza in 1964. He went and he met with the leadership of the PLO, at, I think it was in Cairo at that time. He was bringing back these issues of Palestine before it was popular in a big way, writing an essay called Zionist Logic after he returns, talking about how unjust the Zionist project really was. And in fact, you know, several collections of his writings didn't even reprint that because they thought it was too controversial. But I mean, he was really, through the course of his Organization of African American Unity, cultivating an understanding of what was happening all across the colonized world, but in a big way in the Arab and Muslim world, and trying to bridge those gaps between Black Muslims and Muslims there in the historic Middle East and West Asia, and really opening up the idea that the struggle of Black people was a struggle of colonized people. I mean, he was on the forefront of solidarity with Lumumba, of course, when he was assassinated, and prior to that, to all the other African leaders. Kwame Nkrumah comes and does a big rally in Harlem with Malcolm X to talk more about these issues. Nasser's coming to Harlem. Castro's coming to Harlem. I mean, Malcolm X really was this figure who united so many of the different forces who had this anti-colonial energy around the world, with Black people in the country who were starting to move in powerful ways, 1960, 61, 62, 63, in the direction of their own freedom, and create and build these links in ways that endure till today, which is why almost anywhere you go in the world, if there are oppressed and exploited people there, you always see the image of Malcolm X.
Well, let's say I'm, you know, the average American, and, you know, I heard your ideas, Mr. Perrier, and very interesting, but, you know, I'm trying to make ends meet. I've got a kid going to school. I got my parents, and they're sick. They need health care. I just don't have time for politics.
You know, I would say that you got to make time for politics, because all the problems that you have are directly related to the political system. Let's take a random example. The state of Wisconsin. Everyone knows one of the biggest issues that is out there for people all around the country is this issue of lead in the water and the poison in the water. It's hurting our kids. You know, it only costs $600 million to replace all the pipes in the whole state of Wisconsin, and they don't know if they're going to have enough money. But you have the Congress saying they're going to send $17.6 billion to Israel in their standalone bill. So just the point six of that bill could solve all of the problems of poison water of everybody in Wisconsin. And when we talk about all of the basic programs, you know, $850 billion a year to the U.S. military budget to go over here to Ukraine, to go to these other places, this is the money that is stalling the ability to say, let's have a more expansive child care system. Let's have a better, deeper tax credit. Let's actually have real elder care. So you're worried about your parents are old and are sick. I mean, one of the number one challenges we have in this country is that one of the most difficult jobs that people have that pays the least are those who look after our senior citizens. And so it really becomes this racket where people are being abused in their elderly years. Why don't we have a powerful state-run public system where everyone, when they retire, has the ability to live in dignity and has the help they need to do what they want to do, to have the level of independence? You know, with just a fraction of that $850 billion a year, that would be very easy for us to do. You look at the tax policy, you talk about Social Security, so many people on a fixed income struggling to make it in this country. It's unbelievable. They built this country and now they can't get enough to eat on a daily basis. Well, a lot of that is because we won't tax people to enough money to make sure that Social Security can really pay for people. So the ultra rich, they have this great gold-plated retirement. Everyone else is just making it, scraping by day to day. You look at your roads, you look at your schools, all of these issues are being starved. So your life is being directly hurt. Your life is being circumscribed. Your quality of life is lower because of the policies these politicians are pushing in your name.
And speaking of Social Security, I think the cap is around $160,000. So that means, let's say, hopefully you're getting paid that much. It's the same amount as Elon Musk, as Jeff Bezos, as Bill Gates, as Warren Buffett, as all these gazillionaires. I mean, the inherent unfairness of that is so blatant. It's remarkable that this system continues in the way it has.
I mean, it's almost unbelievable, in fact. And in fact, if you lifted the cap on Social Security, you would never have any issue over the solvency of Social Security ever again. And we see this with taxes over and over again. I mean, the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy does these reports every couple years about how there's usually 30, 40, 50 Fortune 500 companies making huge profits that pay zero taxes every single year because they're able to game the system with all these different tax breaks. ProPublica did this amazing story about how Elon Musk and others are finding all these different ways so that they're paying, you know, the smallest amount of money in taxes while getting away with, you know, what they do. It's an unbelievable system. People have to understand this. They hold all their wealth in stocks and bonds and things like that, that unless you liquidate them, don't get taxed. And what they do is they then, these rich people, they go to banks and they say, well, on paper, I'm worth X amount of money. So if you loan me this amount of money, then I will be able to pay you the interest, because I can liquidate a small amount of my stocks, I can use that to pay the interest, but then I can use the borrowed money to buy my yachts and my mansions, so I can leave most of my wealth totally untouched by U.S. taxes. I mean, the whole system here is so unfair, it's unbelievable, where people who are making $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year are paying a higher percentage of their income to taxes than people making $100 million a year. I mean, it's mind-boggling, really.
We live in a culture of distraction. There's iPhones, there's computers. It's hard for people to find that space to become engaged. So in terms of solidarity, speak to solidarity. Why is it important? How do you create it?
Well, I think the number one way we create solidarity is to get off of some of these devices and get in the same room with one another and really start having conversations and organizing and building institutions. There's no better social network than being with your friends and people who share the same ideas with you in the same room, having a good time, talking about what's important and figuring out how to take action and change it. It's a real interaction is always better than virtual interaction. And I think that's really the importance of solidarity, is seeing that that we're not individualized. I mean, the biggest thing, I think, and the internet has brought many, many positive things to the world. There's no doubt about that. And certainly we shouldn't say that technology is all bad. But I think the number one thing it really has done that has been so detrimental is it's atomized our society in so many different ways. It encourages people to become, you know, part of smaller and smaller subgroups, to be separated, you know, to stay in their homes all day and to not look for interpersonal interaction and all these different pieces. And I think that, you know, it's one, it kills humans are social, right? This is our species, is to be social around others, working with others to solve our common problems. Like, that is actually the most human trait, right? I mean, first it was fire, how to stay warm, then how to grow food and all these other things. I mean, this is what we do. We come together to solve our problems. That's humanity. And I think that realistically, solidarity is the bridge that helps us do that, to understand how other people, even if their struggle isn't the same, even if their situation is a little worse than ours, that we are all in it together and that there is no sort of one person lifting themselves up by the bootstraps. It has to be a rising tide lifting all boats. And I think that's the type of piece we have to move to towards, but we're not going to be able to do it unless we're really able to start to talk to each other and communicate with each other in a way that's real and tangible.
And how do you find that vocabulary to reach people? You know, we're defined as a society as being extremely polarized.
You know, I think it's extremely difficult. I think we have to look for the spaces of common ground, which are, you know, sometimes hard to get to, but we have to see them. I mean, when you have a country like we do, I mean, the Census Bureau now has done something called a household pulse survey. It's a new form of survey. And, you know, you look at one of the things that they study and they find the one a few months ago stated that about 160 million people in this country are having at least some trouble making ends meet week to week. And that's almost everyone who works, 160 million people. So you know that even though there are vast differences, many of us are actually in a very similar situation. 61% of people saying they're living paycheck to paycheck in this country. I think people understand what it means to have high gas prices, to struggle to pay the rent, all these other pieces. And they have deep, long roots and different pieces like that and different understandings about why we ended up in this circumstance. But if we can at least try to start from common ground, then we can debate how we got here and what it really is about. But if we know we're sort of debating a shared circumstance, I think it makes it a lot easier to start to find a way to get some consensus around some reason about why it's wrong and what we need to do to make it right. But I think this is an extraordinarily difficult question, and we have extraordinarily difficult forces working against us to try to keep people from making these forms of connection between one another.
And that speaks, of course, to the role of the media in framing the debate and defining the narrative.
No, 100%. I mean, you know, the thing about the mainstream media is, you know, and as we've already talked about, I mean, people's lives are difficult. People have a lot going on. You have a lot of challenges just making it meet day to day from when your eyes open to when your eyes close. So when people are going to look for information, they're looking for what they can find the easiest. And the mass media with the most money and the best ability to advertise and the best ability to buy the ads at the top of the Google search and all of that, that's the first front of mind source. And if you don't have a lot of time, you go directly to it. And so these sources are able to manipulate the fact that there are a handful of big corporations that can put themselves out in front of everyone else to try to get the attention of people and then use that as a way to give them their narrative, which is always a slanted narrative. And look, there's nothing wrong with having a narrative, but the mainstream media in the United States doesn't present it as a narrative. They present it as these are just the facts, that everything has two sides and we're covering things in a dispassionate way, which leads people to believe that something that is slanted is in fact fair. But the reality is when the New York Times decided to say someone was killed in Gaza but not mention that it was by the Israelis or say what happened or what the context was, that's a conscious choice. When they say that the number of people who died in Gaza is XYZ according to the Hamas-controlled Gaza Health Ministry, that's a conscious choice. It maybe seems small to some people, but it changes the entire way people may view the facts and the statistics that they put forward there. And so I think it's extraordinarily pernicious.
What gives you hope?
What gives me hope is seeing the millions of people who are coming out into the streets, you know, right now around this genocide, to see that in 2020, even in the midst of the COVID pandemic, we had the largest protest movement in history. Maybe 20 some million people protested in some way against racism in the United States of America, which is a deeply entrenched reality. The fact that we've seen, you know, electoral insurgencies like Bernie Sanders, the fact that we continue to see the growth of independent alternative media, that despite every, it's sort of like a rose growing from the concrete, you know, despite the fact that it's almost impossible, it seems, for something like this to happen, you still see these green shoots popping up everywhere. And I think that, you know, there's been tough tasks throughout history. It wasn't easy to get rid of slavery, wasn't easy to get rid of Jim Crow, wasn't easily to establish the labor movement in this country or women's right to vote or anything we want to talk about, but it did take place and it did happen. And the fact that people are standing up, fighting back, being counted gives me tremendous hope.
Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
You were just listening to Eugene Puryear, From Birmingham to Bethlehem. I talked with him in Boulder, Colorado in late February. Eugene Puryear is a journalist, activist, and public speaker. He's a founding member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and he's the host and producer of Breakthrough News. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Medea Benjamin, Arundhati Roy, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Eugene Puryear, From Birmingham to Bethlehem, Parts 1 and 2, and for the classic Howard Zinn book, A People's History of the United States, just call us 1-800-444-1366. 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Hep Ingham, Terry McRae, and KGNU. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Bob Dylan singing Blind Willie McTell.
Seen the arrow on the doorpost, saying this land is condemned, all the way from New Orleans to Jerusalem. I travel through East Texas, burning. Hear the cracking of the whips. Smell that sweet magnolia blooming. See the ghost of slavery ships. I can hear them tribes mourning. Hear that undertaker's bell. Blue.